It's the Pacific Rim Pro Wrestling Podcast, the podcast that takes you from Seattle to Tokyo and all points throughout history. From the Seattle area, back from Tokyo, it's Jim Valley, and we head across the Pacific Ocean, the Pacific Rim, to Tokyo, Japan. And Japan's leading author, historian, and journalist in the world of pro wrestling, my friend, Fumi Saito. How are you?
Hello, how are you from Tokyo?
Good. It's crazy to think our last show was live, wasn't it? We were in your car.
I guess, yeah.
That was so funny. I went back and listened.
It's kind of like being on the road movie or something.
Yeah, it was. We were on the road again, like Tommy Boy or, I don't know, any millions of on the road movies. But as I went back and listened to the show, it wasn't as frantic as I remember it being in the moment. So that was good. It was actually kind of a fun show. Yeah? So that was kind of cool.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah, it didn't feel as organized.
No.
But on we were just there at the show, and we got on the car, and let's do the show now. I'm sure we sounded pretty lively.
Yeah.
And
I've had more rest, so that's good.
Okay, very good.
Long days at Disneyland, and then still jet lagged, and then went to the show, and oh well, it was still a lot of fun.
Yeah, that's good.
So,
but we had there was a lot over here, you know, if you lived in Japan, you know, there are always a lot of shows in Tokyo, you know. Even today, you know, 4 hours from now, there's going to be a New Japan's Ota Gymnasium. It's every March 5th, 6th, okay. Every year, March 6th is New Japan's anniversary show. The company opened its door back in 1972, March 4th, 5th, it was Antonio Inoki against Carl Gotch, but it was March 4th or 5th or whatever. Every year, they go back to the same Ota Gymnasium and run an annual show, you know. And that's tonight, New Japan's annual show. But this Friday, they have Korakuen, and Stardom has Saturday and Sunday, two shows at the Shinkiba. And March 10th, Sunday, Pro Wrestling Noah, new structure, the Pro Wrestling Noah, will have a big show in Yokohama. Last weekend, the same building, Yokohama Bunka Gymnasium, All Japan had its big show there too. And the Yokohama market is pretty big, you know, kind of like go across the river, and then it's not in New York, it's already in New Jersey, you know, you're not in Tokyo, it's already in Yokohama, but it's a, you know, commutable, you know, distance. And Pro Wrestling Noah will introduce new logo and new ring and new storyline, I should say. But everything would start have a new start this coming Sunday at Yokohama.
Well, they've put out the new logo on Twitter, and
yeah, you saw that.
Not surprisingly, when they had the press conference for the main event for the global honor crown, you know, the background
at
was
the Hard
red.
Rock Cafe.
Yeah, at the Hard Rock in Tokyo, that, you know, they had a red background and they had a similar font. So I wasn't really, I mean, I didn't know exactly what they were going to do, but that what they did not surprise me at all. The red with the circle and the black and white with the font. The emerald green and Misawa is gone.
And that the emerald green canvas ring will be gone as of March 10th too. You know, it will be yes and no's though, you know, because if it's Pro Wrestling Noah, it's the company Mitsuharu Misawa is, you know, his brainchild, and the people have this feeling about this, you know, the whole Noah's Ark thing, you know, the professional wrestling company was named Noah because, like a Noah's Ark, you know, that Misawa and his friend and his family, and just like a Noah's Ark, you know, all the animals will be put in the boat and you leave the country, you know, kingdom, you know. And the reason was, King Mr. Baba, of course, had died in January 1999. And Misawa's version of All Japan Pro Wrestling lasted 1 year. And 1 year later, Misawa and his friend decided to leave Mrs. Baba's boat, you know? And that's a Noah's Ark. And it was going to be just five, six guys. But when this thing all came out, all 25, 30 guys, including ring staff or ring announcer, the referee or front office staff, everybody left, you know, but two guys. And that was the beginning of Noah, you know. It was a big story, you know, in 2001, you know. And but it's 2019 and it's not Misawa's Pro Wrestling Noah. And yeah, it's really hard to think then what would Pro Wrestling Noah should mean, you know, in 2019 with new logo and new ring canvas. And what would you look for, you know? What do you look for, Jim, in a new Pro Wrestling Noah, you know, environment? Is this hard, though?
It is hard. And who are the new owners, by the way? Do we know?
Actually, these are the basically wrestling people, you know, the who's been, you know, helping fund Pro Wrestling Noah for the past few years, you know. And this old structure of this Noah company was borrowing a lot of money from these people. I said, this, you know what? We got to buy this company instead. And then older staff, some of these people left. And the new management think they can, you know, make a go, you know, and they think they can run Pro Wrestling Company, you know, running like 120 shows a year and do the, you know, DVDs and the live streaming and run company like they were running before. But yeah, it's really hard, you know, because when you start a new structure or new season or new look, right? They introduce your new logo, you have to have very good reason or the good enough story that we can share and somewhat, you know, you can convince this wrestling audience that hey, this Pro Wrestling Noah is starting over and we want people's support. That's a good one. But yeah, they haven't shown much, you know, what's the reason behind really changing the logo, right? Erasing the, you know, Misawa image. Yeah, but all right, what would Pro Wrestling Noah be without Misawa's image? You know, something new and bigger and something we can look forward to. Well, what's the real, I mean, what is the real reason of getting rid of this green canvas? You know, this Pro Wrestling Noah is the only company in the whole world who uses the green canvas. Do you know any other company? Blue, yes. White, yes. Sometimes black ring, but not the green emerald green canvas. You know, this is the only place in the whole world, you know. And if you are getting rid of that, you know, that the very strong image, you have to come up with something even more convincing or more motivating or something we can believe in. And, you know, you be a part of the new start, fresh start or something. I just don't see that, you know. Does that make sense?
I know Dave thinks he hates it. He thinks the switch from the emerald green is a bad idea. What do you think?
Yeah, but I wouldn't want to say something bad before it starts, but I don't see it. Yeah, but I have problem with that, you know. All right. Why people love this 1948 NWA logo so much? Even people today, you know. Some people start, or even somebody like a Billy Corgan or somebody that wants to buy NWA and the NWA logo and the NWA history and the whole image of it, right? Actually, changing wrestling company's logo or the symbol, right? And changing the color of your ring, that takes a lot, though, you know what I mean? Not just changing it for heck of it, you know? Wrestling fans are not like that. If they are thinking this is going to change, you know, some, you know, good image, and you're gonna start, you know, have the fresh start, and people's gonna come, you know, start, you know, watching Pro Wrestling Noah, something new again. It's like you are leaving something real big behind, you know. history and the memory and logo, all those sentiments are very important in wrestling, don't you think?
Well, I think that I understand exactly what you're saying, and I think that makes sense. But even when Misawa was alive, Noah was still struggling, and once he passed, it's been struggling for a very long time.
7 years.
They have to do something, and this is likely not the answer, but I don't think it's going to make a difference either way. And sometimes if you take something away, like the mat or the logo or what have you, over time, maybe it will make people, absence makes the heart grow fonder. They could always bring it back, and maybe that'll pop some interest. So, yes, it's gone. I think it's worth a shot to try to modernize and maybe get some attention. And if it doesn't work out, they can always go back, sort of like New Coke.
Oh, you can't go back now, though.
You don't
That's
think so?
That's the worst. No. It's like something that you struggled so much. Now, once you change, you cannot change it back again. That's even worse,
I think you can. I think you can be a hero and go, yeah, we're bringing it back. We heard you, and we're bringing it back. But
then you will have to have somebody strong, like somebody like, Kenta Kobashi and Maru Fuji and Jun Akiyama of All Japan all come into a ring and shake hands or something. That's something you can believe in, Not some new management of pro wrestling Noah, who had spent less time than any Noah fan thinking about this thing, whole thing, What is pro wrestling Noah meant,
Yeah, I mean, I am looking at it through American eyes and American marketing as opposed to Japanese marketing.
The wrestling fans are emotional nonetheless. America or Japan, they love history, something you've witnessed so much and something you had spent so much time thinking about it, The reason that original pro wrestling Noah was such a success was that all the wrestling fans witnessed the whole political story, and not the story, but all these historical happening. Giant Baba passing, Jumbo Tsura passing, and 1 year, as a new All Japan Pro Wrestling, Mitsuharu Misawa being a new president of the company, they tried 1 year, then everybody left and got on the boat and went to Nozark, and the new company was success. Without Mrs. Baba's influence, and Channel 4, NTV, went with Pro Wrestling Noah, and following year that the Pro Wrestling Noah was doing Tokyo Dome Show, and it looked historical, Then after Misawa passing in the ring, such a tragedy, and they've been struggling, but there need to be something that we can really look forward to. Some new superstar, like Kiyomiya, make him into new superstar, or have all the title vacant and start over again. Something, Yeah.
Well, it'll be interesting to see what happens, and your thoughts on the first show under the new logo and the new beginning for Pro Wrestling Noah.
Yeah. Oh, it's exciting, but we have to be very careful, Yeah, see what happens. I don't want to say anything negative before it starts, because Pro Wrestling Noah is a good company that there's still somewhat strong following, male wrestling fans, in general, they love New Japan logo. They love UWF logo in image. They love All Japan's Japanese map logo that's been around, close to 50 years. Those are very, important part.
Hey, speaking of exciting, something that we can finally announce, at least that I think is very exciting.
Okay, go ahead.
That you and I are going to be the announcers for the Stardom I pay-per-view that's happening over WrestleMania weekend in New York City, April 5th, 4 o'clock Eastern time, so 1 o'clock here on the West Coast where I am in the United States at the NYC Arena in Queens, New York.
Yeah, and the Japanese, you know.
I think that's super exciting. From what I understand, general admission tickets are available still. The reserve seating sold out a long time ago, but general admission is still available. So if you want to come and see Stardom, we saw a couple of Stardom shows when I was there, and I think it's a really good product. I'm very excited to do this.
Okay, very good. Yeah, it's fun. And I'm honored that I guess we were assigned to do this, and we're just going to do like what we do here, you know, a couple guys talking about wrestling, you know.
Now you've I saw on Reddit when they made the announcement that some fans were talking about it on Reddit online, and someone was saying, oh yeah, I remember Fumi from the All Japan pay-per-views and shows on TV. Yeah, he goes, a lot of people know you as the long-haired guy, which you aren't anymore.
20 years ago.
Right.
Yeah, when All Japan Women's, you know, cross promotion in the mid-90s, in about 8-year, 9-year period, I was doing the color commentary for All Japan's women's show. And so I'm not new for that, you know. And also Rossi and I were doing this together then. And it's a different company, but Rossi and I have been friends, you know. So,
Rossi Ogawa, the founder and president of Stardom.
Yeah, and it was 8 years ago or so. One day he called me and said, you know what, I'm doing the wrestling company again. You what? You know, this was interesting, you know, because it was after All Japan Women and after his short-lived RCN company, and he wasn't doing a whole lot, and we kept in touch. But one day he called me and said, you know what, I'm doing the wrestling company again. It's like, again? Are you sure? And that was the beginning of Stardom. Yeah. And it's been very exciting. Yeah. It's all new talent, you know, no previous 90s superstar. You know, he started from scratch, you know, every single star is a new one, you know? Yeah.
And that's where Io Shirai and Kairi Sane came from.
Yes. They were rookies. Yeah. Oh yeah. So they developed new talent and a whole new generation of wrestlers, and therefore a whole new generation of wrestling fan base too, which is exciting.
There was a great match that they had in Nagoya a couple of days ago where the Wonder of Stardom champion, sort of like the Intercontinental champion, Momo Watanabe.
White belt.
Yeah, the white belt.
Momo Watanabe.
Fought Jungle Kiona, and they had a really good great match.
Oh, today's main event.
Yes.
Yeah, it goes. Yeah. And if you noticed, Rossi took this image from All Japan's old structure, red belt, WWWA, you know, World Women's Wrestling, you know, Worldwide Women's Wrestling Alliance, WWWA World Champion, red belt, and also All Pacific, like your Intercontinental belt, which was white, red belt and white belt. That the image is still there. So the biggest belt for Stardom is all still red, but the second belt is the white belt, which Momo Watanabe holds right now. And Momo Watanabe is very special for Stardom's fan because she debuted when she was like 14. Now she's 13 probably. Like she was like 8th grade or 9th grade when she started. Then finished high school and everything, and now she's 18, 19, and she already got like 6 years experience and grew up in front of audience. You know what I'm saying? Yeah. So Momo Watanabe is a very special star for Stardom's, you know, fan base. Yeah. Been watching this girl since she was 13, you know?
There's a lot of talented women. There's you mentioned that the World of Stardom champion is Kagetsu, and she's sort of like the lead heel right now, and she's very talented.
Oh, very talented, very talented. And also she started with Sendai Girls Pro Wrestling, you know, some 12 years ago, and she was also the one, you know, her wanted to, you know, do more soul searching and left the Sendai Girls Company and worked was a freelancer, you know, for quite a few years. Then at the end, ended up being with Stardom.
She has a ton of talent. And then, of course, another big star that people probably know because she won the Women of Honor Championship is Mayu Iwatani.
Right, icon. Yeah, she's been with Stardom Company since the day one. You know, a lot of girls, you know, debuted and with their own reason. Some of them quit, some of them retired, some of them left, you know, but Mayu Iwatani stayed with the company all these years, you know, and she's the original, you know, member, which is good, you know.
Yeah, there's a lot of talent. There's a lot of good matches. There's a lot of young and up and coming talent as well, like Konami, who was trained by Asuka.
Yeah. It worked like Asuka too.
Yeah. So there's like I said, there's young girls who are just starting and they're literally still in school. So you've got a nice mix of people who are established, who put on great matches. You've got a lot of young talent. And then it even has, you know, a little bit of, I guess, what, you know, Vince would call entertainment factor. There's a little bit. There's nothing stupid or dumb or embarrassing, but there's a little bit of entertainment too. So I think it's a nice balanced wrestling product.
Yeah, I think so. Then we got to introduce that to American audience this time.
Yes. You know? It's going to be on Fight TV on April 5th, okay. So you can get it either if you want to buy it for the one show, it's like $9.99, or Fight TV is offering like a package for like all of the shows that they're running that WrestleMania weekend. So you can either buy it, you can buy it a la carte, or you can buy it as part of a larger package as far as like all of the shows that are on Fight TV.
What are the groups? Like, House of Glory or?
Yeah, there's like a million of them. Hang on, I'd have to look it up.
Right, House of Glory has Great Muta and Tajiri together, right?
Probably. Let's see here. What do they have? Yeah, Fight Fest.
Yeah. Okay.
Let's see here. Hang on. There is.
What show is Sabu and Rob Van Dam's on?
You know,
it starts like a Thursday at midnight or something.
Probably. Yeah. Are they on Joey Janela? Are they on that one?
I have no idea. Yeah, we'll find out, okay?
Here's what I have. Okay. So if you buy the Fight Fest, I think it's like $119.99, so $120. And like you get everything that weekend. I'm just looking at some of the shows. So you got Josh Barnett's Bloodsport.
That's a big one, yeah.
Yeah, you got WXW. You've got the WrestleCon.
WXW.
Kaiju Big Battle.
That's like a Chikara.
Yes, there's Chikara. There's Shimmer, it looks like. Joey Ryan has got a show. There's a lot of different shows that you can get. So you go to the Fight TV, fight.tv for more information. I don't think I have it exactly perfect. But either way, you can see the Stardom show because I think it's going to be great. It's called American Dream 2019 in the Big Apple, the NYC Arena on 144th Place in Queens, New York. General admission is still available, and
we're taking subway.
Yeah, you could probably see Fubi and I on the subway. I think it's the same time that Dave and Brian are doing their live event at WrestleMania Weekend, their Q&A thing, I think.
At the WrestleCon?
I think so, yeah.
Okay. Yeah, there's a more thing besides WrestleCon, too.
Yeah.
There's so many over the weekend. And let's do this Pacific Rim show right after Stardom show then, from New York. Still want to go to WWE Access one afternoon, I guess. And New Japan is doing something similar to Access, too, you know, the night before Madison Square Garden. And also people, I want to go NXT takeover too, you know. And if you went to Madison Square Garden, you couldn't make it to this Hall of Fame this year. It's hard, you know.
I'm not that compelled to go to the Hall of Fame this year.
Yeah.
Usually it's like
it's
my
always,
favorite
always
thing.
Be my favorite, yeah, favorite night of the, you know, the whole weekend. That, but they haven't announced anybody, but, you know, D-Generation X and Tolly Wilson and Honky Tonk Man are the only ones, right?
Yeah, so far. Oh, and allegedly, supposedly Brutus Beefcake is on the list too.
Okay. Running thin a little bit. You know,
well, when you have, you know, five or six members, whatever it is, of Degeneration X, I think that takes up a lot of time.
Right, right. Oh, definitely. Definitely.
But someone,
they're the biggest star this year.
I guess DX is probably the headliner, I suppose.
Yeah, yeah, they can be. I don't see many legend, you know, this year.
No, this is kind of light.
Yeah.
This is kind of light this year. I mean, taking nothing away from anyone, but I'm not that compelled to hear the road stories of Tori Wilson. No disrespect to her career. She had a fine career and everything, yeah. But, you know, I like the stories. I like the road stories of all the stuff that happened and all the things that they did. And,
sure,
and I just don't know
who experienced the real territorial, you know, era. And, of course, something really learned from the old time or something.
So, by the way, I've had a couple of people ask us if we are doing any sort of Q&A, and as far as I know, we are not, because I don't know how to set up anything, and you don't know how to set up anything. But follow us on Twitter, follow me at Jim Valley, and then Fumi at Fumi Hikodayo, and, you know, we'll be around. So if, you know, for some reason you want a picture with Fumi,
we always answer questions.
We'll be around, so we can connect in a more personal basis, as opposed to having some sort of event, which I don't know that we're at the event level.
Or in the afternoon, we can all meet up. Let's say right in front of Madison Square Garden or something.
Yeah, you know? We'll do something informal, like just like that.
Yeah.
That's more our style, yeah. I think.
Yeah.
Hey,
all right.
Aside from Stardom, and by the way, check out Stardom. It's pretty cool. You can go to stardom-world.com. There's a lot of, like I said, I've been watching a lot of the product lately, and I've really found myself enjoying it quite a bit. So it's
okay, that's good.
It's a nice balanced product. King Kong Bundy passed away.
Yes, we have to touch that.
Yeah, he according to the New Japan tweet, he did like 70 matches in Japan.
Yeah, I guess so. He had like a three or four tours just in 1985. We have to go back to 1985 and, you know, do a little bit of not homework, but it was right after, fall to winter of 1984, okay? My very first version of Maeda and Takada Fujiwara's UWF people left New Japan, about 10 guys, okay? And also September of 1984, Riki Choshu or Kuniaki Kobayashi, Kirakan, Masa Saito, about 15 wrestlers left New Japan, okay? And Dynamite Kid, Davey Boy Smith went to All Japan and all those things. And it was just weeks after New Japan had lost maybe like a 40 guys, you know, and there was like you had like a real skeleton, you know, roster. There was Inoki getting old, but Inoki, Sakaguchi, Fujinami, and Kengo Kimura, and Ruki Liger, Ruki Muto, Ruki Hashimoto, Ruki Chono. It was still skeleton, and Joe Daigo of Calgary. He's not with us anymore, but Joe Daigo was a scout and also a trainer in North America. But Joe Daigo signed King Kong Bundy to become a number one international star. And King Kong Bundy was brought in as of January of 1985. That was the year King Kong Bundy was going to be a headliner of New Japan, okay? And the very first tour, even it was a tag team situation, Inoki put King Kong Bundy over clean 1-2-3 in the middle of the ring. That doesn't happen too often, okay? And that was the time that King Kong Bundy had his first single match against Hulk Hogan. 1985 was the very last year that the New Japan and WWF had partnership. As funny as it sounds, March 31st of 1985 was very first WrestleMania, huh? Remember?
Yes.
You know, Hulk Hogan, Mr. T against Roddy Piper and Mr. Wonderful. But even after that very first WrestleMania, Hulk Hogan was still making regular trip to Japan during the course of 1985. then 1985 was the last year that the Vince decided that there are no more partnership, that they're running 300 shows a year just within the United States. And none of these talents are going to Japan anymore. So they stopped Hulk Hogan, Andre the Giant. You have your Adrian Adonis, all those WWF talent. They all stopped coming to Japan. And King Kong Bundy was going to be the somewhat an answer, that he was going to be the top talent, international talent. And he was going to have a program against Antonio Inoki, which he did, you know, body slam challenge match and such. And it was during the tour that Hulk Hogan and King Kong Bundy met in Japan. And I guess Hulk Hogan looked at him and said, this guy's a tailor-made for WWF. And the following year, 1986, WrestleMania 2, sure enough, Hulk Hogan against King Kong Bundy was the main event of WrestleMania 2. That was the story.
Well, and he was also, King Kong Bundy was also on WrestleMania 1. He defeated SD Jones in what was supposed to be a match
10
that
seconds
lasted
or something?
9 seconds, yeah.
Something like that, right. But it was still not under exclusive contract, you know, that the New Japan wanted to use King Kong Bundy as, you know, its full-time superstar like they had, you know, with Hulk Hogan and Andre the Giant previously. Years to come, you have, you know, Bam Bam Bigelow, the Vader, the Scott Norton, all those people who exclusively worked for Japan. New Japan was going to create those Japanese international superstar, King Kong Bundy. But he got signed away, you know. And I guess pretty much Hulk Hogan and WWE, I don't want to say stealing, but he pretty much stole King Kong Bundy from Japan. So, yeah, 70 matches, fine. But in the course of 6 months period or something, in the very beginning of 1985, King Kong Bundy had about 4 tours with all Japan. I mean, New Japan. You know, real quick, short, you know, 6 months period. He was going to be a star, but he pretty much left, you know. But it was a major impact, though. Scouting, you know, really scouting roster of New Japan. Inoki's still on top, still on 8 o'clock Friday night, you know, prime time program, that they had to have card. They have to have story. You have to have, you know, good lineups. And yeah, if King Kong Bundy has had he stayed with New Japan, maybe he could have been a much bigger star in Japan. But that's not how it worked out. It was good for Bundy though. He became superstar in America.
How do you think he would have? I mean, how do you think he would? Had he stayed in Japan, had history been different? And it all played out the way it was designed. How do you think he would have done?
He could have been star, yeah.
But I mean, do you see him like a Vader or a Stan Hansen or?
No, when you talk about Stan Vader, you have to have longevity. You know that they were committed. You know they worked for a Japanese company for 15, 20, 25 year period. You know, I'm not sure if Bundy was so committed or not. You know, it all happened so quick, and Bundy was brought in. He was put in the program with, you know, Inoki right away. Inoki putting Bundy over clean in the ring, 1, 2, 3, and everything. They clearly had plans, didn't they? Not, you know, it so didn't happen. And then the following year, you know, UWF people came back, and you know UWF and New Japan had this long feud. And 87, Ricky Choshu and his group came back to New Japan. Then that was the year also they created Vader, Bam Bam Bigelow, and all those. So kind of like Bundy was in this short period that he had to be in. I'm not sure he worked on that, you know. It's hard to say if he, you know, had he stayed with New Japan, was he able to become much bigger star or not? It's hard to say. Yeah.
I don't know. I mean, I saw a lot of his career. I saw him in Georgia and I saw him in Dallas, obviously, in the WWF, both times. I never saw him in Japan. And according to what I'm looking at online here, it was February 6th, 1985, with Hogan and Bundy on the same card. So Hogan, Hogan worked fast. But given Bundy's style of work, you know, he wasn't, I just don't know that he would have taken all that punishment.
Right. He wouldn't be Vader. Yeah. Big guys, right? But the Vader, Bigelow, Scott Norton were the ones who's a big guy who can work Japan style, right? Yeah. Maybe he had to, you know, he would change his ring style while he was in Japan. You know, maybe, you know, Vader, completely Japanese style, right? You know, and Bam Bam Bigelow can do either way. Therefore, he was utilized, you know, like putting people over in roles, you know. But yeah, I'm not sure about Bundy. You almost have to use King Kong Bundy as like somebody who just does a whole bunch of squash, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And, you know, he was kind of washed up by like 1995, 94 when they brought him back.
Oh, the second run? Oh, God. He was much older. And also he had retired for years, you know. He was gone for a long time, you know. Yeah.
So, I mean, that's something to think about.
Tailor made for, yeah. But it's good, though, older Japanese generations. We're talking about 1985, you know, 34 years ago. Just like we're talking about something that happened last week, but for most people, 1985 is a long time ago, right? So, yeah, different era.
I always thought that his build-up to WrestleMania 2 came out of nowhere, just the one shot on Saturday night's main event. It's like I felt like he didn't really have, like, he didn't have a year of just killing everybody on TV.
No, I
thought that was really bad planning, and I thought they could have made a much bigger deal out of his challenge for WrestleMania, but I just thought it was flat. That whole card was flat.
Most of Hulk Hogan's opponents were that way. The only one that had 1 year build up was like people like Macho Man Randy Savage and Ultimate Warrior. You know, everybody else, you have your King Kong Bundy to Big John Studd to Magnificent Morocco to, I don't know, John Tenta or somebody. They're all a bunch of Hulk Hogan's opponent that he just going through, right? So he was just one of the 10, 15 guys, I guess. You know,
yeah,
was perfect for Hulk Hogan's era, you know, and that the angle was pretty simple too. You know, you run into, you know, make running to Saturday Night Main Events, Hulk Hogan's match, and give him a splash and break his rib or something, right?
Yeah. Oh, yeah, I mean, it worked really well, but I just thought they could have done a better job building him prior to the big splash.
Right. Then the WrestleMania cage match wasn't all that great either, you know. Uh-huh. But the people do remember that second year WrestleMania from three different locations: Nassau Coliseum in Chicago and LA, 1 hour here, East Coast, 1 hour in Chicago, and third hour in LA. And just it looked like spectacular, didn't it?
It was interesting because they had all of those B and C and D list celebrities, and it was just, you know, they had the guy from Burger King, Herb, who was like a one time gimmick for Burger King. They had Claire Peller from Wendy's, the Where's the Beef lady. They had G. Gordon Liddy.
Yeah.
They had Susan St. James and Kathy Lee Crosby, who nobody remembers. And it was just, they spent, I don't know how much they spent, but it just seemed like, just like a lot of nothing, but I don't know, like the back page of People magazine.
Oh, I enjoyed the Smokey, Roddy Piper against Mr. T, second year boxing match. Joe Frazier was somebody second. Yeah.
And Lou Duva?
Yeah. So I thought it was interesting. And also three locations and three different broadcasting teams, you know, Mean Gene team, Jesse Ventura team, and
Vince McMahon team.
Yeah. So I thought it was interesting. Three different locations and three different broadcasting team. It made it huge. I mean, big company.
Elvira did a great job, I thought, really.
L.A., yeah, L.A.
Yeah, in L.A., yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah. So that was, I think, King Kong Bundy is a memory, or the people, you know, associate with. King Kong Bundy was very, you know, big part of, you know, beginning of WrestleMania era, you know? Yeah. The match didn't have to be good, you know, but the main event of WrestleMania 2, the blue cage, you know, that cage that they don't use anymore. But at the time, WWF cage match cage was that blue thing, you know, and people remember that, you know?
Yeah, you know, chances are, given King Kong Bundy's look, he probably would have ended up in the WWF at some point eventually.
Oh, of course, of course. Yeah. Perfect opponent for Hogan.
Of course. He's the quintessential Hulk Hogan opponent when you're talking about the size and the evil look and all of those things.
Simple. Yeah.
Yes, very simple.
Yeah, very simple. Yeah, yeah. So it was good. But interesting enough that Inoki wanted to use him, you know, before WWE, you know. So Inoki had pretty good same idea, you know. It could have been perfect opponent for, you know, aging Inoki, you know. Yeah. Really devastating opponent.
Yeah, that's a good point. Inoki was getting older.
Yeah, yeah. And Bundy was one of his very last program opponent, you know. And was willing to put him over 1-2-3 in the first weekend. So it's like, well, you got to take care of this guy, right? It was interesting.
You mentioned Scott Norton, and I, as we're recording this, I just interviewed Scott Norton today for my other show in The Observer, the Portland WrestleCast. Scott is a former Pacific Northwest champion, and while he was in the AWA, you know, they weren't running many shows, so he needed more experience, and he came to Portland.
Sure.
But
not knowing much.
Yeah, no, but he had already been kind of scouted by New Japan, and New Japan was like, yeah, get some more experience, and that's how he kind of found Portland. Yeah. Talk about Scott in New Japan.
Oh, this is one of the biggest stars of 90s. Yeah. And it was a loyal, you know. He did sign with WCW at the end in NWO era, but on he was with New Japan, you know, every tour back to back to back to back to back, and was placed in the top position, you know. Was never a smooth worker, like not as smooth as Vader or Bigelow or somebody like that, but Scott Norton was always so big and convincing, had a very simple power slam finish. He was very easy to understand, the big American guy, you know. And and also, he's from Minneapolis, and he's like a Masa boy, you know, obviously. And,
Masa Saito.
Masa Saito boy. And then, New Japan fan took Scott Norton as, okay, this guy is a new American monster. So believed in him right away, you know, had a real good career, you know. Yeah, they talked about Bundy's 70 matches in Japan, right? But Scott Norton had 150 tours with New Japan in 10-15 year period. 150 tours, though. That's a lot of tours. A lot more than Stan Hansen did. Yeah. Or Brody or Vader, for that matter.
Yeah, well, and he was one of the
Scott
few.
Scott Norton lasted longest, I guess.
One of the few Americans to hold the IWGP championship.
I guess so. Yeah, I guess so. Who else? Hulk Hogan.
I guess course. Hogan, Vader.
Vader. Bigelow didn't have it.
No.
Don Fry, maybe.
I don't think he did, but I could be wrong on that. Off the top of my head, I want to say no.
A short period of time, yeah, yeah.
Well,
yeah.
I guess
not too many though.
If you're just talking foreigners, I guess you could include Kenny Omega on that.
And AJ Styles in recent memory, yes.
Yeah, AJ, of course.
Yeah, but not too many. Not too many. Yeah. This is a real hard title to hold, you know? Yeah, there's a hierarchy there, you know? Yeah, Adrian never got it, you know? Yeah, Dick Murdoch didn't have it. Yeah. Yeah, so... Yeah, Scott Norton was treated very specially, yeah.
Oh, he held it twice. Why did I think he held it only once? He held it twice, apparently.
Beating somebody like Chono or Kensuke?
I guess we you know who we forgot? Bob Sapp.
Yeah. Ah, Oh, that's like a completely like epitome of our dark age of professional wrestling in
Yeah,
Japan.
that's easy to forget. We forgot Bob
Yeah.
Sapp.
Right.
And
He wasn't
Brock.
even
We forgot
wrestling.
Brock. Dark Ages.
Right, Brock Lesnar and Kurt Angle was brought in for a short period of time. Yes. Yeah. And at the time they weren't even working in America, you know?
Does that count? Does Kurt Angle count? Because he was sort of like the IGF champion.
At the time, yeah. It's kind of like your NWA history or AWA history or WCW history. Sometimes it's, you recognize certain wrestler as a champion who is not on the record or something. And, if you remember, Ric Flair and Fujinami had a program, right,
Yeah.
in Japan and America, but the WCW record does not show Fujinami as a champion, you know? Or, back in 1979, Antonio Inoki beat Bob Backlund in Tokushima and clearly won the belt, but it's not on WWE record, you know? And things like this happen. This is wrestling, you know? So I don't know what's the official history of it, you know?
Yeah.
What we remember, that counts, you know? Yeah.
Let's touch base on just a couple of quick things here. The New Japan Cup.
Yeah. And also, yeah, about this, King Kong Bundy's passing. So let's touch briefly on Billy Robinson's 5 years
Yes, it's been fun.
anniversary.
Sure.
Yeah, 5 years, and also 3 years since Hayabusa's passing. It was a quick, but I just realized it was 3 years it's been. Yeah.
And you knew both of
People
those
did
guys
post
pretty
about
well,
this.
right?
Yeah. Oh, both Billy Robinson and Hayabusa, and yeah, two different, completely different people. But yes, I did spend a lot of time with Billy Robinson, and I did spend a lot of time with Hayabusa. Completely different era, completely different, from different crowd, But yes, yeah. Billy Robinson was very, very special in this country. Yeah. And Hayabusa was a superstar in certain, in this millennium era. And also he, what was so amazing was that after 15 years after he got hurt and paralyzed, he was still wearing masks. And he was being Hayabusa after he was paralyzed, being on wheelchair and everything, but he shows up with his mask on, and that was very special, if you know what I mean.
Yeah, FMW was fairly popular too, and a lot of it had to do with on the strength of Hayabusa.
And the things you and I talk about a lot, it's like wrestling fans are fans of individual wrestlers, but a lot of times wrestling fans are fan of the company and the group. If you remember ECW, wrestlers are great, but a lot of ECW fans loved ECW itself, right? As a, like a movement, or the style or revolutionary force that changed wrestling. FMW was the same way, We always had Inokis in New Japan, Giant Baba's Old Japan, very big major league traditional group with network television and everything. But in 90s, we had more varieties. People liked FMW, what Onita did. And was not even on the network channel, but that was a VHS era that people did collect videos, and that went all the way to the States. And people watched a lot of Onita's old videotape and Hayabusa's videotape in America. So there was a, certain group of fans that knew about FMW, Onita, and Hayabusa and whole revolutionary things. And that was very 90s. Yeah.
And what about Billy Robinson?
Billy Robinson had his different history. First trip over here was 1968. He was very first foreign star that were babyface. In 50s and 60s, Rikki Dozan era to young Giant Baba, young Antonio Inoki era, almost automatically American superstars were treated like international stars though, but somewhat heel because
Right.
local stars are big baby face, And
just like everywhere in wrestling, just like in Mexico or the United States,
I guess.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's changed, you know, somewhat now with the times, but back then, you know, everywhere, you know, the Canadian stars were the top stars in Canada and obviously Mexico. And yeah, they come in as
an outsider heel, huh?
Yes, exactly.
Yeah. But that too, but Giant Baba has, you know, changed that though, because the Funks, you know, you bring in Dory Funk and Terry Funk, you're obviously American babyface. You know, then Dory Funk and Terry Funk going against people like The Sheik and Abdul the Butcher, obvious heel. So there were American babyface and American heels that we enjoyed it. This is what it's like. Japanese wrestling fans are basically more reading oriented, right? And the wrestlers should be what you read on the magazines, you know? Yeah. You and I talked about that before. So see, three weeks ago when Pedro Morales died, Giant Baba in Old Japan would bring in Pedro Morales as babyface New York superstar image. But when Inoki and New Japan brought in Pedro Morales, they made him heel, you know? So almost uneasy that, look, Pedro Morales is a nest, you know? And you want to see your superstar like you read on the magazine, you know? But sometimes they change it without even telling you. You know, so that was a difference between New Japan and Old Japan too, you know. And Billy Robinson was very interesting because he came in as a top star of IWE, International Wrestling Enterprise, then switched to, you know, New Japan and had a one tour with Inoki's New Japan and had a 16-minute Broadway in December of 1975. That one time only happened once. Inoki Billy Robinson match 45 years ago. So still older fans still talk about that match today. And 6 months, then in 1976, 6 months later, Billy Robinson switched to All Japan. Then he had a single match against Giant Baba. So Billy Robinson was one of the very few American, or British, but the international superstar who had single match title match against both Inoki and Baba at their prime. You know, not too many wrestlers did that, you know, so very special. And later on, Billy Robinson was brought in as a UWF's coach. In 1999, he actually came to Japan and lived here for 10 years and trained people like Sakuraba and, you know, all those guys who went against Gracie's in MMA. You know, Billy Robinson still had his very current story, you know? Yeah. Very old fashioned guy. Yeah. He's pretty much missed here in Japan. People do talk about Billy Robinson even today.
Probably, as time goes on, we should probably, I hear that things are not well for Dick Beyer. We'll have to probably talk about Dick Beyer one of these days.
Yes. Yes. He was one of the very, he's very special. We should spend the whole, you know, 1 hour program on Dick Beyer too. He was a rival of Ricky Dozan, rival of Giant Baba, and he was the first American wrestler who actually moved his whole family to Tokyo, and he actually lived here full time for 7 years or so. And Dick Beyer's kids, three kids, two sons and daughter, all graduate high school in Japan. They all speak Japanese. And Kurt Beyer was just here a couple of days ago. He still does some business in Japan to this day. Yeah. Interesting, huh?
No, that is interesting. It's always fascinated by Dick Beyer, and to see him every year at the Cauliflower Alley Club, and, you know, he's in his 80s, and he
still wears the mask.
He still wears the mask, and he was as sharp as ever the last time he was there, like last year, I think it was, maybe 2 years ago, tops. But we should all hope to be as spry and as sharp as he was the last time I saw him, and hopefully he'll be able to pull out.
So respected by his peers.
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah. So, because this is one of our roles that, do not let this history, just pass by, we can talk about Dick Byer, or maybe we should interview Dick Byer, you know, and then, yeah, we can share more stories, you know.
His book is pretty good, too, from a couple of years ago.
Yeah, yeah, okay. Was that about the Buffalo New York wrestling?
No, it's a whole book about his life. Yeah, it's
okay.
I forget what the title is, but it wouldn't be hard to find.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Oh,
and
yeah.
Okay. I also have a Destroyer mask that I bought from him at Cauliflower Alley, and the bobble.
Is it?
I have the bobblehead too, the Destroyer bobblehead.
Oh, okay. I have the Destroyer dolls and also Dr. X T-shirt. Yeah.
The ones that were in all the magazines.
Yeah, yeah, from Minnesota. Yeah, they did the reproduction of it in recent years, and they do have Dr. X mask. I mean, T-shirt here. The funny thing is, though, Dick Byer never worked as Dr. X in Japan. Was always Destroyer. Yeah.
Well, we'll do a show completely on Dick Byer in the very
right. We
very
talked
near
about
future.
Stardom. We covered King Kong Bundy, a little bit of Billy Robinson, a little bit of Hayabusa, and there were a few questions that we have to
sure.
Answer.
Hey, real quick though, what do you think about this year's New Japan Cup? Is it sort of like the Royal Rumble this year, where only a few people can win because the main event, the winner is going to main event in New York at Madison Square Garden?
Yeah, I'm sure they have the card, but they cannot announce it until this tournament is over. The winner of the tournament will face Jay White, IWGP champion at the Madison Square Garden. They cannot announce it until this tournament is over. It looks to me will be Kazuchika Okada, obviously. Yeah. See what happens. It has to be American against Japanese for the main event at the Madison Square Garden, right? Not two Americans, not two Japanese wrestlers going against each other. The main event has to be one American against one Japanese.
Well, Jay White isn't he New Zealand, but one Westerner and one Japanese.
Right. English-speaking white,
yes.
White guy.
One Anglo, right. I guess. Yeah, I don't know if he'd be considered Westerner, but I understand what you're saying.
Yeah, yeah. And also, yeah, Western white person champion.
Right.
And at the Madison Square Garden, the challenger will be Japanese superstar. You know, it looks to me that the Okada this time.
Interesting.
Yeah?
No, go ahead. Go ahead. Finish.
No. Only 3 or 4 weeks away, they haven't even announced the whole card yet.
Well, that's what I was going to ask you about is with, you know, they're going to run Dallas, they're going to run London. You know, they're going to run two nights in Tokyo, a Tokyo Dome, with this ambitious year and likely more to come.
Yeah.
Will New Japan, Ghetto, whomever, will they have to change some of their booking philosophy? Will things have to change or tweak because they, you know, the New York City crowd will be disappointed by certain results, or people will not want to go because maybe they're not going to see something. They will be conditioned to think that they're not going to see something historical. But do you think there'll be changes in New Japan booking or presentation because of the different schedule now, the increased schedule?
This is two ways to look at it. They have the schedules way ahead of your storylines, right? I mean,
right.
Like a schedules, you know, like what months in summer and the fall and the winter, they already book in the building and all those things in schedules way ahead of time. And they cannot really show all the storylines coming, you know? And I'm sure they're working on the storyline, but the one way to look at it is though, that the New Japan's logo and let's say G1 Supercard or something like that, the logo and the name of the event itself will sell it. Like Royal Rumble, WrestleMania, SummerSlam, Survivor Series, they don't usually announce your lineups and detailed card, you know, up until 2 to 3 weeks before the actual event. So this can work, you know. You can always say this year's WrestleMania or this summer's SummerSlam or the Survivor Series or Royal Rumble. The event name itself is a draw. And lineup, they can still work on it as the weeks, you know, go by or something. Yeah, it's impossible to, you know, put all the lineups ahead of time now, you know. you have to be running the shows and storylines and angles every week, you know?
But do you think that if they, let's say that Okada wins the New Japan Cup and it is Okada against Jay White, judging by past history of New Japan booking, is it a little early for Okada to win? Don't they need to put heat on Jay White and then maybe eventually have Jay White lose at Wrestle Kingdom next year?
I am hoping that Will Ospreay will win IWGP Championship this year sometime. Heavyweight, no more junior heavyweight. That Will Ospreay will become your heavyweight superstar and will be on the top of the line, you know, your lineups for all the New Japan Big Show to come. You know, there's a consensus even within the New Japan company. I mean, I only spoke with a couple of people, but even some of the New Japan serious hardcore fans, they don't look at Kenny Omega's leaving as that big of a loss at this point. You know, some of these people, as long as you have Will Ospreay, you have your big, huge superstar for the next 10 years or so. When Kenny comes back, great. But the consensus is out now that Will Ospreay will be your main guy soon, sooner than we think. I don't know where this, you know, Jay White will fall into, though, because some people think he's ready. Some people don't think he's ready, you know? I mean, to carry the company. Does that make sense?
I think he's done really well. I think you could argue that maybe he's not ready, but he's consistently grown and has shown grace under pressure, I think.
Yeah, and also 2005, 2004, 2006, John Cena wasn't necessarily the best worker either, you know? Yeah. But he was obviously main event, you know? And they went with him. And before you know, John Cena had 10-year history, you know? So it's too early to judge Jay White. He's doing very well, I think, you know? He's doing very well. I'm not sure if he can be as big as John Cena or anybody like that, but But for the natural ability and that it's like a people's confidence, Will Ospreay might go above Jay White at this point. Yeah,
I can
see
that.
And also, he's not. Yeah, and then also, he Will Ospreay still talk about 5 years ago, you know, just five short years ago, he was changing light bulbs at the people in the old lady's house, you know? And 5 years later, he's an international wrestling superstar. He is not wanting to go to WWE at this point, you know? He wants to have 5 to 10, you know, to commit 5 to 10 years with New Japan, I think, you know? And that's what New Japan needs, you know?
Absolutely.
The guy's really talented, you know? Really talented. He finally won me over, you know? I wasn't sure about Ricochet against, you know, the controversial match, you know, that the Vader made case out of, you know, Ricochet against Will Ospreay. Is this a style of wrestling, or do they look too much like a, you know, PlayStation 4 or something like that? But wrestlers, young generation wrestlers all over the world already started emulating Will Ospreay style right now. So Will Ospreay is the original, you know, like original guy for the style of 2020, you know? And New Japan should make Will Ospreay IWGP heavyweight champion before too long, you know? I mean, as soon as summer, maybe even this summer. I think Will Ospreay will go into G1 Climax this year as a heavyweight for the first time. G1 Climax meaning you have 10 dream match single matches, night after night after night, you know? So see what happens this summer. It's too soon to talk about summer, but yes.
Well, nicely to find out. I got to find out if Dave's going to G1 Climax.
Okay, this summer. Okay.
Yeah, and I may go. To be honest, I'm a little like, I don't know that I need to go. I mean, I was just there. But my wife is pushing me to go. Carrie is pushing me to go. So we'll see what happens.
Well, that just, you know, come to summer and witness Nippon Budokan 3 nights in a row. You know, it's like having Madison Square Garden 3 nights in a row. You know, they got to do something big.
It seems like an overdose of wrestling. It seems like a lot of wrestling, but we'll see.
Yeah, I know.
We'll see.
You and I never get sick of it, you know?
No, I had a super fun time. I don't know if we had a chance to talk about this, but for the Baba show, that was incredible. And thank you for letting me tag along. And we met your friends and we sat in the incredibly uncomfortable box seats. And, you know,
Watched Mil Máscaras match for the first time live.
Yeah, you see, you got to see, you know, decades of talent going from, Mil Máscaras from the 60s all the way up to Shun Skywalker right now.
You know, yeah, and you got Antonio Inoki to Abdul the Butcher to Dory Funk Jr. to...
to Muda.
Tanahashi.
To Tanahashi.
Sekimoto or somebody, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, the ridiculous number of names and history on one card, you know, you've got to put that right up there with virtually any card in history, just not for the matches, but when it just comes to the sheer number of historical talents under one roof.
Yeah. Yeah, and then lots of love.
Yeah, lots of love.
Lots of love, yeah. No hate.
It's a cool show.
Yeah, well, I thought so too.
Well, let's do a couple of questions here. Let's do a couple of Ask Fumi questions. So here's a question. We're getting through some of them from last year. So we need to do just a show just about questions one of these days and get caught up. But
we can do that. Yeah.
Anyway, here's a question.
I feel that the people are listening out there. So the listeners out there, we want to share stories, you know?
Yeah, we'll do that. We'll have to just get together, find some free time, and just do a question show. But he wants to know about Masakatsu Funaki. Could he have been a bigger crossover star as Minoru Suzuki was with pro wrestling?
Ooh, you know what? First 10 years, you know? See, those two are always compared. You know, Minoru Suzuki and Masakatsu Funaki. They started same age, you know? They're both born 1969. And Funaki barely finishes, you know, 9th grade, 10th grade, and he debuted with New Japan Pro Wrestling in 1985, right before his 16th birthday. Minoru Suzuki did finish high school, and he was a high school national champion. And same age, they joined New Japan right after high school, and those two are living in the dojo together, and they're friends. Then they went to UWF. Then they went to Fujiwara's group. Then they created Pancras. Pancras later on, as you know, became complete 100% MMA company. But when Funaki and Minoru Suzuki created Pancras, it was the professional wrestling that they wanted to, you know, to be, you know, I mean, all real, not a real, but I hate the word real, but you know what I'm saying? The two young wrestlers, you know, who created, you know, started a new company. We want to make this wrestling a legitimate contest, you know. Then you had people like, you know, Ken Shamrock or, you know, Guy Metzka, and you had our friend Paul SMB, and they, all these people tried out, and they were still part of professional wrestling. But for some reason, after Hicks and Gracie fight, Funaki pretty much quit and left the wrestling world. And Minoru Suzuki was somewhat underdog underneath Funaki for a long time. He was the one who outshined everybody later on. He did not retire from Minoru Suzuki, I'm talking about. Minoru Suzuki did not really retire from Pancras. The company Pancras told him to retire. Then he wants to go back to traditional professional wrestling, go back. Then Suzuki had different idea. That's like denying professional wrestling. I am not going to retire. I'm going to stop. I'm going to have a last match with Pancras and going back to pro wrestling on my own. And the very last MMA fight at Pancras ring Suzuki had was with Liger. They brought in Liger with mask, a short mask, not the full costume, but the same Keiichi Yamada Liger came into Pancras ring and had MMA match against Minoru Suzuki. So Minoru Suzuki can graduate from Pancras and go, you know, go pursue your wrestling career. And it was a good story, you know, good story. And people's been watching Minoru Suzuki like this is his story, the long story, you know, to, oh, the whole wrestling career from New Japan to UWF to your Tokyo Dome era to Pancras era to going back to All Japan, New Japan, Pro Wrestling Noah, now back with New Japan with his own faction. Just Minoru Suzuki had this, such a decorated career that the people has to follow, you know. And at the same time, Masakatsu Funaki, who could have been much bigger star, he kind of lost his momentum somewhere there, you know. And then he wasn't on the public eye for like 6-7 year period when Keiji Muto decided to bring Funaki, you know, as a regular professional wrestler for his version of All Japan Pro Wrestling. People did not pop, you know. It was like you and I talked about that. The momentum is a very funny thing, you know? Yeah. Yeah. So Minoru Suzuki is much bigger star now than Funaki is now, though.
Another question here. I want to know about, we talked about him with Stardom and All Japan Women. The question is, how much of an impact did Rossi Ogawa have on All Japan Women's success in the 90s? Was he the booker for all of the big inter-promotional shows?
He was not a owner of the company, you know, but he was pretty much head of creative. And also, he was the one who, Rossi was the one who actually had the actual meeting with people from, you know, JWP, you know, Japan Women's Pro Wrestling, LLPW, you know, Ladies Legend Pro Wrestling, you know, Kandori and those people, LLPW, and also FMW, Onita's people. Rossi was the one who actually sat with those people and went over on ideas and plans. And you got to sit down. You got to do something serious. Somebody's going to do the meeting, right? And Rossi was always the one who actually sat with Onita, sat with JWP, and sat and had a meeting with LLPW. All those negotiations was done by him. So that was a very strong position he was in. Yeah.
We talked about Scott Norton. We have a question here. How did the NWO Japan form? Was there a big angle akin to Hogan's turn at Bash at the Beach 96?
Like your summer bash, you know,
yes,
thing. That was 97, was it? Was it 96 or 97?
It was 96.
96. 90, after G1 Climax Tournament of summer of 95, Chono was still wearing white costume as he finished 95's G1 Climax final match. He turned on fan. Then the very next day, he brought in his black costume, you know, top to bottom. That was his heel turn. And he formed his own faction. And following summer, he went to America and hooked up with WCW, NWO, and ran an angle and videotaped the whole thing, and he became NWO Japan. And if that's what this person was looking for, that's the angle they shot, you know? But, yeah, not like one-night thing, but Chono had his heel faction, and he went to America and videotaped WCW Nitro, to be part of Nitro TV taping. And also he ran a storyline that he signed up with NWO and he became NWO Japan officially. And people were brought in, like, Buff Bagwell, the Mike Rotondo, the Jeff Farmer, if you remember, Fake Sting.
Yes.
Yeah, he was regular. Buff Bagwell was regular.
What was he? It was Michael something Walsh. J. What, I can't think of it.
Super J?
Super J, thank you.
Yeah, something like that, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. And, or Tenzan, or Hiro Saito, and other people. Even at the end, Great Muta became part of the NWO Japan. So it was like, almost riding a coattail of NWO phenomenon, but it was one of the very first angle in Japan that they happened simultaneously. What's taking place in WCW in a major league in American pro wrestling, and same logo, same faction, NWO was brought into New Japan as like simultaneously happening. You know, Hulk Hogan did not come in though around that time, but Scott Hall and Kevin Nash did make a tour once or twice.
How popular was the merchandise, the T-shirts?
Oh, real popular, real popular. Yeah, yeah. Super popular, because you see NWO logo T-shirt, black T-shirt, and the NWO logo baseball cap and stuff on subways and trains and stuff. I mean, they don't look like wrestling fans. So the merchandise was huge. 97, 98, 99. Yeah. Yeah. Oh, Scott Norton was part of the NWO too. Yeah. Was huge. Eric Bischoff came in a couple of times. Yeah, ran angle, everything.
And then they switched to Team 2000.
Yes, there was a falling out too, you know, probably. At the time in America, there was a white NWO and red Wolfpack NWO. And they changed storyline week by week. And you couldn't even follow it for a while, right?
Oh, no.
Yeah, so... NWO white logo storyline didn't last that long. Not as long as we thought it would, you know. Then I guess there was merchandising rights that New Japan had to pay WCW or Turner Company or something. They decided not to do it, and they wanted to create something similar, NWO similar. So it was like a T2000, Millennium's Coming. Team 2000 logo was replaced with NWA logo, and probably some of these people didn't even notice. You know, it was Chono's group anyway, you know, new T-shirt, new logo, you know. They did not destroy or they did not end NWO angle that clearly. One day there was NWO T-shirt, and next door quietly it became T2000 T-shirt or something. That's how I remember it.
Yeah, that sounds about
maybe
right.
Maybe they did run angle, but I cannot remember small angles. I'm sorry.
Hey, yeah. With the advent of AEW bringing in, Oriental Wrestling Entertainment, Shima's group out of China, someone wants to know about why there wasn't much on the Dragon Gate split last year, and how do fans feel about, fans in Japan feel about Shima and his stable leaving?
Shima was like your icon of Dragon Gate, huh?
Yeah, I mean, he kind of was Dragon Gate. That was kind of the weird part.
Yeah, he was the most people believe, you know, the most people associate, you know, him with Mr. Dragon Gate, huh? It wasn't so, I guess. That the funny thing is, though, Dragon Gate fans only follow Dragon Gate. You know, they don't watch any other groups. You know, this is it's interesting, isolated that... leaving Dragon Gate with three of his protege, fine. But just as soon as Shima's gone, fans of Dragon Gate are watching new storylines of Dragon Gate, though, you know? So it's more of Shima's, his personal project to create a new wrestling company in China. I mean, mega potential, right? I mean, people talk about potentials of Chinese market with Chinese money and technology and all those things. But nobody has succeeded professional wrestling in China yet. Isn't that something?
Well, you know, it's not just wrestling. There are a lot of companies that see China as the last big market to open up, because there's, you know, 7 trillion
It hasn't been able to do it.
No, and a lot of companies have not been able to crack. So it's going to be interesting to see if what can happen.
And also, you're talking about people like Disneyland too, right?
You know, there's a Shanghai Disneyland and a Hong Kong Disneyland, but yeah. I think once the novelty of Hong Kong kind of wore off, I believe attendance at Hong Kong has not been that strong.
Yeah. And also Shanghai, big city, big deal, but it's not the whole country. You know, China itself is as big as US, right?
Yeah,
You know, this
kind of
should be
bigger.
a huge market, but
Right.
they Chinese people don't have history for professional wrestling. You know, either it's all circus and all the acrobatics and the trampling and all those things with kung fu fight, or is it going to be MMA? You know, wrestling is something that the only I don't want to say it, but the mature pro wrestling mentality is needed. You know, the being entertainment or being MMA or legitimate contest or the show business, actually, it's not the big of an issue. If you love wrestling, you love wrestling, and it will become market. But for some countries, in some culture, you just have to classify everything. Is this a kung fu fight like Bruce Lee movie? Is this going to be your sports entertainment, or is this going to be your MMA? You know, in some culture, you have to really have to have clear definition of it. Wrestling is great because there is no definition. It's a backward, isn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah, because we don't question it. We've been watching wrestling some, you know, f f 30, 40, 50 years, and the question is always there. But you keep watching wrestling because you love it, you know? And you start answering questions for people with less knowledge, you know, something, you know? And yeah, for China to have big wrestling market, you will have your Bruce, you will need Bruce Lee, you know? And I'm not sure if Shima and his group will be the Bruce Lee, you
Right.
know?
Did we ask the
Yeah.
question about union organization in Japan? Have we talked about that?
Wrestlers Union, there
Yeah.
hasn't been.
Is
Yeah.
there any
Just
sort
like
of
America.
collective bargaining or any sort of unions for wrestling in Japan and on any of the
No,
organizations?
hasn't been and never been to. And because all the companies be in competition with each other, huh? And wrestlers and workers have never really unionized it here, you know? Yeah. And that's another issue that we have to do more homework on, because there hasn't been, never been
All right.
here.
All right.
Yeah.
Well, let's we've gone kind of long, but that's okay. We
Okay.
well, let's you want to do you want to do one more, wrap it up?
Sure,
All right,
sure.
one more. Someone wants you to explain Hustle. What did you think about it when it was
Ooh.
more active,
Can
and
we
what do you
talk
think its
about hustle some
legacy?
other time? Well, some hustle is another epitome of our pro wrestling's dark age. You know, there was like a 5-year period wrestling.
Okay.
I almost believed wrestling was gonna be gone finally. I mean, like there is not gonna be any more wrestling. God, all my childhood was gonna be all gone. What was wrong with hustle was that it was run by Pride people. Pride was a big MMA company at the time, okay? An MMA company wanted to run professional wrestling, and they thought they could do it because it's all theater. It's not, is it? You know, the motivation was all wrong, the money was all wrong, the people who brought in was all wrong, that the people who was writing the show was all wrong, and I'm so glad when it was over. Yeah. Yeah, it was like a real bad memory on
Yeah,
my part.
there was the general character, the guy who had like the military outfit. Was Tajiri a part of
Takara?
it for a while?
Yeah, Tajiri was part of it. The guy with Hitler costume was Nobuhiko Takara, of all people.
That's right. Yeah. It's
Yeah,
kind
of
of
all people.
it's really vague in my mind.
Yeah. And also, they went one extreme to the other end of the extreme. See, Nobuhiko Takada, you know, maybe two or three before, you know, previously to that, he was Mr. F, you know, UWFI,
Yeah.
and he was going to make professional wrestling legitimate sports. He was, you know, he had a Tokyo Dome single match MMA fight against Rickson Gracie and all those things. Lost, right? And then following year, he was wearing this stupid Hitler costume and wanted to make professional wrestling entertainment. But the definition of entertainment, there wasn't a philosophy to it, you know? they thought they can go all comedy and people buy it. I don't, you know. Oh, it was such a real bad memory. You know, the hustle was like they thought they were catered to smart audience, you know, like a smarter wrestling audience who has watched everything and read everything, you know. But those are the wrestling fans still want to believe in wrestling, though, just like you believe in what you love, you know. And it's not like you don't want to be told that this is all entertainment. And the hustle storyline was so dumb, you know. And it was like a really insulting our intelligence, yeah, at the time. Does it make any sense?
No, I think it makes perfect sense. Do you think it has any sort of legacy at all, or do you think people just kind of shoved it under the rug?
Some people did enjoy it. I personally hated it, and I was so happy that when it was all over. And if there's a legacy, yeah, you can call it somewhat a legacy, you know, because it lasted, what, 5-6 year period? And they were running Yokohama Arena, the Saitama Arena, they're doing a Budokan show. They were running big, big buildings at the time, you know. And they brought in people like Abdul the Butcher, Kevin Nash, Mick Foley, Bob Sapp, or they even brought in people like Goldberg at the time, you know. But it just was so wrong, you know. Yeah. And just something wasn't right, you know, when you go over there. So, that's how I remember it, you know? Yeah. Hustle, huh?
Hustle, dark there it period. Is. Yeah, definitely, yeah, the dark period.
The dark period of wrestling. Before we had Tanahashi, before we had Shinsuke Nakamura, you know, before we had, you know, all these young, you know, like a new generation of start to be, you know, arriving, you know. Yeah, it was a really tough time.
Well, we covered a lot of great stuff today. I think this is...
I think
you did awesome. I love the talk about Will Ospreay and King Kong Bundy. I think it's going to be awesome. And I'm really looking forward to calling the Stardom show with you. It's going to be fun.
Yeah. And Will Ospreay will be a huge Japanese star, you know, if he's not going to WWE, you know? Yeah. Yeah. We didn't talk much about the AEW, huh? Let's do it next time.
Well, let me do this real quick. I did this. You refreshed my memory. When we were in Japan, you did a Q&A or a radio show or a podcast or something. What was that? You did like some call-ins, and like all of the questions said were about AEW.
Skype show thing. Yeah.
And all of the Japanese fans wanted to know about AEW.
Yes, because they feel, a lot of people feel that it's like almost like a Japanese company opening, you know. Well, probably because Kenny Omega and Young Bucks, Chris Jericho being involved, and guys like Hangman Page and all those guys, and they were just here, you know. And Kenny Omega, executive vice president, he announced it, and running a... Oh, let's say the main event of your AEW May Memorial Weekend card is the main event is Chris Jericho against Kenny Omega, right?
Yeah.
And they were calling it Alpha against Omega 2. Two? Like, they were assuming that all these fans ordering AEW pay-per-view or live streaming in May already have watched Tokyo Dome Chris Jericho and Kenny Omega match. They're assuming it. So they're calling it Alpha against Omega 2. Their opening show, though. It's like, why call it 2, you know? And so a lot of Japanese fans think it's like something related to Japanese wrestling scene. They want to know more about it, you know? Yeah.
Well, we'll see what happens as time goes on. I'm curious
We'll know more about it, though, yeah.
You know, like, for example, I know Kenny Omega has recruited some of the women. I'll be curious to see if there's any other women.
Aja and Aja's people, yeah.
Yeah, I'll be curious to see if there's...
Some DT company, yeah.
It'll be interesting to see what happens if he tries to get any women from Stardom or Sendai Girls or you know, was it Tokyo Women, Tokyo Joshi or whatever.
Yeah, it could happen, huh?
Yeah, it'll be interesting to see who they take next and if they come from Japan.
Right, and Kenny Omega is the one who's doing it.
Yeah.
You know? Yeah, from what I gather, he still lives here, so.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Well, this was a great show. I think we covered a ton of stuff, so I hope we made up for a tiny absence. Where could people get a hold of you on Twitter?
Fumihiko Dayo, FUMIHIKODAYO, Fumihiko Dayo on Twitter, or you can find me, Fumi Saito, on Facebook.
I'm at Jim Valley, JimValley, on Twitter and on Facebook, so be sure to follow us there. And if you have questions, tag both Fumi and I and use the hashtag AskFumi. It's just much easier for me to organize, so be sure to use the hashtag AskFumi. It helps me a lot. So until next time.
So long from Tokyo. Thank you.